This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the week's news at our website, wnpr.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We are live today from our New Haven studio at Gateway Community College, and we're joined by all sorts of great New Haven insiders, a lot of insight into what's going on in the Elm City. And there's kind of a lot happening right now in New Haven. We're going to get to that in a moment with our guests, Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent. Hello once again, Paul.
Hi, John. Great to see you.
Great to see you as well. Dr. Jonathan Warden is here. He's assistant professor of political science and urban affairs at Southern Connecticut State University. Hello there once again, Jonathan.
Morning, John. Good morning, everyone.
And also, welcome to Dr. Kalila Brown, Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Hello there, Kalila.
Hey, John.
So much to talk about, but let's actually start at the state capitol. We haven't really gotten your takes yet about what's happening in this transition from Dan Malloy to Ned Lamont. We've talked about this a little bit, Kalila, but I think it bears repeating. Ned Lamont is a different kind of guy than Dan Malloy. Here's one way in which he's different. Lamont has invited GOP lawmakers to a Valentine's Day budget meeting. And I think that it's a little bit emblematic of the type of outreach he's trying to make. We're going to talk maybe about some specifics in his budget, much as we know about them, that he's going to roll out next week. But what about the way that you've seen him interact so far with lawmakers, both from his own party and across the aisle?
Well, I think what's different is that he's really trying to reach across the aisle and across constituencies. So he's not this sort of charismatic figure, but there's a genuine interest there. And so I think it will be interesting to see what's on the menu during this meeting, but more importantly, what can come out of it. The very rapid response to the impact of the furlough on government workers in our state, reaching out to the business community, that I think is a welcome change, and we'll see what happens with it.
Well, it's on Valentine's Day, so love is on the menu.
Love is on the menu.
Jonathan, how about you?
That's funny that you see it that way, Professor. I see it very differently. Yeah. I guess it should be expected coming from me. I wonder if this is more symbolic politics as opposed to substantive politics by doing something like this, just getting the word out there, thinking that, oh, you know, we can find pathways of working together. How long will this be sustainable? And is it really more symbolic as opposed to practical politics?
Symbolic or practical, Paul?
Guess I landed between Kalila and Jonathan.
Yeah.
I think that he said a lot of the right things about the debt diet, about working with Republicans. I totally agree with Jonathan that the proof's going to be in the pudding. So he hired a hedge fund manager as chief of staff. He hired a corporate criminal predatory capitalist to be in charge of economic development. What's that going to mean when he rolls out the budget? Are we going to have aid to cities? What's he going to decide with the hospitals? Is he going to be like Malloy saying that's where the money is? So like a bank robber, I go where the money is. There's some tough decisions that it's great he's sending some good signals, that symbolism matters, but it's all going to come down to what he's going to do about a $2.5 billion projected deficit again.
This is the part at which I follow up on something that you've said, Paul. Maybe you could fill in the gaps a little bit on the corporate criminal that he's brought.
Well, you know, wow. you're harder than I am.
Well, you know that nobody
who's
went
the Republican
to jail
in the room now
from
so
all the financial companies that through illegal activities helped bring us the Great Recession. One of the people who should have gone to jail is instead the new appointee to economic development for the state of Connecticut. And I had to write down his name because I'd heard Dave Layman. He's one of two people in the room who came up with a scheme when they bought all these toxic mortgages to try to get Goldman Sachs' own clients to invest in those mortgages and then bet against them at the same time and then lie about it, say we heard it was a good investment on the street. He goes before Congress and they say, what'd you mean about on the street? Said, well, we were the street. We heard inside it was a good investment while we were. So in other words, the guy lied. He lied about lying. He cheated people. He helped as much as any other corporate criminal in this country create misery for millions of people and plunge a world recession. And he's not going to be telling us how we're going to fix New Haven. I'm a little skeptical. I want to see the details.
Well, can I add to this at least? I mean, Colin McEnroe did a great job, obviously.
He did.
You know, writing that up. So shout out to him, obviously. We certainly miss him today. But the thing is that I can't believe I'm the skeptic on this. This is almost typical in many administrations, right? If you go across states, you do see a lot of people who are playing a role in economic development, who are chiefs of, you know, the agencies across many states. They're working from Goldman. They're working for many of these corporations. They come up with these packages. I hate saying that this is nothing new, but you see this at a lot of the state level. They don't bring in, quote unquote, experts or people who do economic development. And it's kind of unfortunate, right? You'd think that there'd be that
well,
way.
Well, the argument is that if you've been in business, you know what you're doing. So
right.
Like Yale
right.
brought in the head of Procter & Gamble years ago, and he did a great job. He wasn't a thief, and the unions worked with them and they did a good job. But we have a sector that is totally unproductive capital that just exists to cheat people who don't know what they're doing out of their money, and then play a Ponzi scheme with the last one holding the Capitol, you know, is the one that goes broke. And to have those people running our government just doesn't inspire tons of confidence in me.
Kalila?
Well, I think it's the real challenge right now for the country is the realization that running a business is not like running government, and it shouldn't be, because there are certain services that have to be delivered. You can't be driven by a bottom line profit motive the way that many people operated in the business sector. So the concern is what gets lost, what gets trimmed, who is expendable, and if this is the track record of deciding that we're going to put profit over people, how does that translate in government? Does it mean that coming in with this baggage sort of raises the level of accountability and vision? I don't yet know that. But what I do know is that at the end of the day, Lamont has inherited a mess, and getting out of it is not going to be neat. And anyone who suggests that it will be, no matter how much they like him as a person, is naive.
Yeah, and I think one thing, to be fair with this administration, is he's not saying it's going to be neat. He's saying that there's an awful lot that has to be done. One of the things, Paul already alluded to it, that he said this week is he wants to, as Keith Faniff, our friend from the Connecticut Mirror, says, slam the brakes on state borrowing. His plan, the plan that Lamont's administration is putting forward, is just slowing down the amount of bonding, making it difficult for Democrats in the legislature to obtain borrowing for small community-based projects, labeled by some as pork barrel spending. Jonathan, what do you see about this this slowdown in spending? Because it has gotten us into a lot of hot water. Other economists will say you need to do a certain amount of this kind of borrowing if you're going to stimulate the economy and you're going to fix things that need to be fixed.
I think it's only a start. You still need to do more. It was welcome news to see that this came out, but I still want to see what's he going to do to grow Connecticut's economy. What are you going to do to attract the big corporations? Now, I'll give Ned Lamont his credit. At least he's going out there and trying to get a company like Amazon, right? I mean, we're seeing a lot of that in terms of coming back to Stanford and considering and putting it back on the table in light of what's going on in New York. But I still want to see more plans, at least as it relates to more.
But what does that look like in your mind? Because, I mean, the way that the Malloy administration approached it with the old DECD is we're going to hand out packages to a first five, and there's a whole separate group of money for smaller businesses. And there are a lot of questions raised about whether or not that has actually shown the type of economic impact that it was supposed to have shown. I mean, what are you talking about when you say bring new businesses? What does that look like?
You know, I don't know, because I'd love to see something in terms of a plan that would say, okay, we're going to bring in more corporations here. I haven't heard much beyond that right now at this point. But maybe it's too early in the administration, to be fair.
Yeah, Paul?
Yeah, I think to be fair, and again, this is where I go between Kalila and Jonathan, I think the words matter. What matters more is results. Mm-hmm. I disagree with Jonathan that the respectfully that it's about bringing in corporations. I think that's a bad deal. We saw that with Foxconn. We're seeing that with Amazon. I think Lamont's rhetoric is correct, that I think he's right to try to keep spending under control, but then target investment at infrastructure. By infrastructure, I mean a combination of tech infrastructure, which Malloy did a good job, by the way. We're doing great in New Haven with a lot of innovation and creating new jobs. There are all these like little offices we don't even hear much about where they're doing R&D for these companies at like office towers.
I think
you got to invest in a tech infrastructure as well as in cities, just in transportation, quality of life, and schools. I think that's what grows good jobs, honest jobs.
I will ask you, I mean, you know New Haven as well as anybody, though, Paul. A large part of what drives the tech sector in New Haven is you got a lot of smart people who go to school here. They want to spend their time and money here afterward. You've got better schools than maybe in some of the other cities because of that. You have maybe some better transportation infrastructure because of that. We're going to talk about the many problems the city has in just a moment. But a lot of that is organic in New Haven and not driven by what's happening at the state capitol in Hartford.
I guess I would respectfully disagree with you, because I think you're right about that would set the conditions for it to happen in New Haven, but didn't happen for a long time. Starting in 1982, we had a science park that went nowhere until both Yale made a new decision by creating a new Office of Cooperative Research, and the state and the city did make targeted investments. We have a Elm City Collaborative that is state-funded. It's helping hatch a lot of new businesses. And actually, transportation is the weakness that we got to work on. But I think, in fact, there have been targeted smaller state investments, not the kind of corporate welfare you give to the Foxconns and the Amazons, that I think do help tip the scales.
Kalila?
Yeah, I think the other part is we think very much within the narrow confines of cities and towns in our state. And I think we have to start thinking about growth in an inclusive way that is a regional approach. approach so that it's not just about going out and trying to recruit these corporations. What are the ways that we can cultivate smaller businesses here? Who are the entrepreneurs that we have in our state that can create those jobs? But then you need alignment so that you're aligning and creating the workforce that you need. That goes to education and it goes to schools and really preparing people within the state to host the jobs or hold the jobs that we hope will either come here or will flourish here.
Real quick, Jonathan, what do you expect to see Ned Lamont really talk about in next week's budget address? How does he address any of the things we're talking about when he goes in front of the, you know, all the lawmakers and all the state and says, here are my plans for this next couple of years?
Well, I think she just highlighted, I think the good professor over here just highlighted the fact that we did need to discuss something about regionalism. I mean, let's just admit that. We have an addiction to home rule. We love our fiefdoms. We have 169 of them. Everybody likes to be separate. I respect that, especially as a New Englander. But the question I have, at least for Ned Lamont, I think he's going to push this. What pathways can we do to better regionalize and certainly to share resources and address a lot of the problems, not just financially, but even politically among all these towns? I wonder if that's going to be in there in the budget.
Yeah, what are you looking for, Paul?
So Lamont talked about that the night he won the primary. So I'm going to give you a carrot and a stick. I'm going to give incentives. You get reward in your state, and I'll help you keep property taxes under. And I think they're looking at boards of ed. We have 150 boards of eds with fewer students overall than the one board of ed in New York. They're looking at 911 response centers. I think it's a good idea. You have to be forceful to make it happen. Ned Lamont's not forceful. He's obviously hired some predatory capitalist sharks, so maybe we'll be forceful. So we'll see.
Well, you're holding back so much today.
I know. Where's the Jaws theme song at this point?
And a last thing on that, though, Kalila. I mean, the idea that some of these things are going to get done, whether or not it's breaking up the whole idea of home rule, for towns in which they think things are going just fine, thank you very much, with my police or with my, my kids' schools, they really, really don't want to do this. And that's, you know, we can talk all we want on the radio about what would be best for the state, but in any given town, they're thinking about what's best in my town.
They are, and it's the reason why many people move to the towns that they do, because they want to escape the problems of urban cities in Connecticut, or they want to have this control to know that when they see their first selectman at the farmer's market, they can tell them their grievance and it will be responded to immediately. So the idea that we need to share the burden, I don't know that that translates to voters who say, wait a minute, that's not what I want, and I'll show you why.
We're talking with Kalila Brown, Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science from Quinnipiac University, Jonathan Wharton from Southern Connecticut State University, Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent, and we're talking in the wheelhouse today. When we come back, we're going to talk about an entirely different state, a place where Kalila grew up, a place that maybe shows us what actual political dysfunction looks like. That's Virginia. But we're also going to zone in on the place where we're sitting today, New Haven, Connecticut, and a lot of problems going on with the police department and with the city budget as well. We'll be right back in the wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're broadcasting from our studios at Gateway Community College in downtown New Haven. So we've got a whole panel of great New Haven insiders. We're talking with Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent, Jonathan Wharton, assistant professor of political science and urban affairs at Southern Connecticut State University, and Kalila Brown, dean, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Once again, our friend Colin McEnroe is on the mend. We hope to have him back soon. If you're listening right now, Colin, why are you listening to the radio? Start to feel better. Start to get better, and we'll have him back very, very soon. I want to start with you, Kalila, in this segment because we have talked in the past about you grew up in Virginia and you went to school in Virginia and you know an awful lot about that state. And I thought that maybe, you know, by last week, this little political scandal in Virginia would kind of have wrapped itself up. Someone would have resigned or stepped down or something else would have happened. But it just seems to be compounding itself. And once again, for people who aren't paying attention to this on a daily basis, you basically have both the governor and the attorney general wrapped up in scandals having to do with appearing in blackface in their past. And one of them, at least, probably not understanding exactly why that's a bad thing. And the other one, understanding why that's a bad thing and coming out and saying it, but that's, you know, maybe problematic for him politically. In the middle, a lieutenant governor who is African-American, who's caught up in a scandal having to do with a few seemingly credible sexual assault allegations. So my first broad question to you is, what the hell's wrong with Virginia?
Well, John, put it out there.
Such a New Englander.
I know. But Here's what I will say. You know, there's no secret that I am a Virginia native, that I love that state dearly. Most of my family is still there, and it's the place that I go for refuge several times throughout the year. But what I also know is that what's happening in Virginia is not unique to Virginia. I think the timing, the context that you now have your three highest ranking officials all embroiled in their own scandals is different. But the fundamental question is, the same way that the governor does not realize that blackface is a problem is the same reason that we have college students who put on blackface and post it on their Snapchat, or who dress up for Halloween and not realizing that we're talking about a culture and not a costume. At issue in Virginia right now is, for me, the saddest part, is that people are more concerned with maintaining a balance of partisan power than they are with the real damage that's being done. We are just two years away from white supremacists, Nazis, nationalists, anti-Semitic people marching on the University of Virginia. So at the same time, you have this space, this university created by Thomas Jefferson, the supposed ideals of U.S. democracy being embedded there. And now, 30 years later, you're having this debate about blackface. My hope is that the people of Virginia will decide what's best for them, but they will do it with a real keen eye to communities, to representation, and to power, and not power in terms of which political party they want to reign.
And I'm wondering if you can just pick up on that a little bit, because, again, we've got Democrats in these top three elected positions. It seems unlikely at this point that any of them are going to step down. So maybe none of them are going to lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. If they were to all lose their jobs for some reason or another, the next person in line is actually a Republican. Mm-hmm. But how much do you think that partisan politics has played into all this? And how much of it is just the thing that you said earlier, which is these ideas about race and racism clearly are deeply seated and are misunderstood, not just in Virginia, but all across the country. And there's probably all sorts of people, mm-hmm. like Governor Northam, who are maybe coming to grips right now with the idea that they just don't get it. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not just him, not just the governor's office in Virginia, but like millions of people in America waking right. up today and saying, I just don't get it.
And there are people who think that, you know, this is about being too sensitive. This is about, you know, trigger warnings and snowflakes and safe spaces. And for me, it's not about that. It's really about saying, what are your values? And who gets to decide that what you have done has been so egregious that I get to say to you, you don't deserve the mantle of public office. You can't tell people, you know, we were talking during the break, this is the 400th anniversary of enslaved Africans arriving on the shores of Virginia. The governor still has not declared Black History Month as a state recognition. And this is also a state that less than 10 years ago recognized Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, and Martin Luther King on the same state holiday. That's deep-seated. That is the culture of America to decide who gets to be represented. And the last thing I'll say is that there is no chance that all three of these men will step down on the same day. So the idea that we pick off the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and now the Republican speaker steps into office, there are ways, if people are worried about the, you know, succession, to maneuver that. But at the end of the day, there will be a statewide office election again in November, where Democrats and Republicans will have to have these conversations. Expect more of these pictures to be leaked out and released based on who steps up to be a leader in the state.
And Jonathan, you were commenting during the break, too, mm-hmm. about the, as Governor Northam tried to clean up the mess by sitting down and talking with Hartford's own Gail King and answering yes. questions about this, it seemed clear that even at that point, even after having been briefed, after having been in the news for a couple of days, he still doesn't get it.
Even after reading, you know, Roots, you know, the book, and he even admitted to that, he still would at least label slaves, at least Africans who have been enslaved, as indentured servants.
That was how he led.
Right. You know, and as the professor said there, I mean, 400 years of history here and with the state. Now, I have to confess, I'm a little bit biased. I have a lot of Virginia love, only because my family, my father's side of the family, is from Accomack. I don't know if the good professor knows it, on Eastern Shore, that area. And I have cousins of mine who live in Northern Virginia. And I'm spending a lot of Thanksgivings over there. So I've gotten to know a little bit more about the state. You know, it's quite interesting because it's almost the opposite of Connecticut in some ways. Yes, it's in the South, but the county government there is very strong. And the roots of regionalism is pronounced there. And so it's very, very different than Connecticut. So I've been just mesmerized as a political scientist, certainly following it, but even as somebody who has an attraction to that state. There's something unique and different there, but the history is certainly ingrained in there, as she had said. And I'm just curious as to what's going to happen next.
And Paul, I guess I wonder what we can learn here. I mean, we make jokes about Corruptocut. We've had a governor who's gone to jail and then actually went back to jail again. We've had a number of big city mayors who've gone to prison. We have our own types of problems. As we sit here from our not entirely high perch in Connecticut and look at Virginia, anything we can learn?
I think a lot we can learn because we deal with our own racial issues. I think Kalila, I happen to agree with her that it just takes different forms in different states. Mm-hmm. I think one of my questions is, what do we do once we decide that an issue's out in the open? So I was very struck by forgiveness in the black community. 60% of black people in Virginia allegedly want the governor to stay in the office and work with him to enact an agenda that is good for the African American community. So I don't hear much discussion about what do we do now? How do we make it right? Do you have any thoughts on that?
So no black person that I know, and I know quite a few, in Virginia was surprised by this. You know, we grew up through this. I graduated from the University of Virginia, where classmates who were lovely to me in class went to their frat parties on the weekend and dressed up in blackface. Or they had thug parties where, you know, it was every exaggerated social stereotype about black people that you could imagine. So I fully expect that at some point yearbook photos will emerge with my classmates. So there was no surprise there. I think that less than about being forgiveness, it was about people saying, what is most important to us? Being offended by what we know to be true or being afraid of what may come? So the very fragile gains that have been made on comprehensive criminal justice reform, things I never expected to see in my home state. But it is wonderful to consider that 1 in 4 African-American men who were previously not allowed to vote because of a past conviction now have the opportunity to have a say in the school board and the curriculum for their children. So that kind of progress is about them taking an overall view to say, what's more important? How do we get to where we need to be while still recognizing that the past is prologue in our state?
A last thought from you perhaps on this, and I'd love your thoughts as the panel. You brought up forgiveness, this idea that it goes out there and we find a picture from 30 years ago. And obviously, with any misstep in public life, you want to have some contrition, you want to have some idea of understanding. I'll ask you first, Kalila, but I'd love thoughts from our other panelists too. I mean, what about forgiveness in the public sphere? At what point, when we look back and see that we have any number of white politicians who have something in their past, or African-American politicians who maybe have something different in their past, if they have said, I understand and I've grown from that, How should we move forward in forgiving them as politicians and as people?
So forgiveness does not come without consequences. Mm-hmm. So you don't get to go on TV and say, maybe it was me, maybe it wasn't me. Me personally, if I had ever worn a Klan hood, that's not something I would forget, just saying. But then when your next response is, well, I did put some shoe polish on my face to be, what was that guy, Michael Jackson? And you all know it's hard to get polish off your face. That to me is not that you are sorry for what you did. You are sorry that now your political future is in question. So I think politicians and public figures have to be aware of that. And then the public has to hold them accountable. We can forgive you. We can move on as a state. But that does not mean you get to not be accountable.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I kind of slammed this whole thing, and I suggested even on Twitter, everybody should just resign because I've been fed up with it. I think the fact is you broke the public trust. You know, people voted for you based on a certain, set of elements and your character, integrity, and you're a public official. You're supposed to hold up at least certain values and morals, and yet that's been broken. So I've been very much hardened against this kind of thing. They're supposed to be exemplars. These are public officials who hold the public trust. How dare they come through the way they have? I mean, maybe I'm a purist in this regard. I don't know if I can forgive, and I don't know how the voters of Virginia can do the same.
Steve King's in Congress. President Trump's in the White House.
Yeah. Welcome to America, Paul.
Period.
So we'll put a period on that. And we'll move on to the town where we're sitting, New Haven, Connecticut, which has, like a lot of cities in Connecticut, some problems with its finances, but perhaps more pronounced right now with what's happening in the city. New Haven Police Chief Anthony Campbell plans to leave his job March 29th for a position in the New Haven State's Attorney's Office. That isn't so unusual. When it's part of a mass exodus, though, from the department that has left it with about 100 fewer police officers than this time last year, that is kind of unusual. And I know myself, I've never really heard about a police chief leaving over health care benefits. Let's hear a bit about that from Chief Campbell during a recent interview with WNPR's Lori Mack.
Medical is very important to me. I've had some medical issues over the years, particularly since I got hurt in the line of duty, and I need to keep that medical package.
So, Paul, I'm going to start with you, and we can get into the big issues as to why this is all happening with the New Haven Police Department and what else is happening at City Hall here. But I just have to say, I hear about police chiefs in cities like New Haven all the time moving on to a bigger town or moving on for a different type of challenge. But I never hear a police chief, including one who, by many accounts, has been successful in his job, saying, I got to get better benefits, man. It seems shocking to me.
Right,
should I be shocked?
This is a chief who's been scandal-free. He's overseen a drop to the lowest violent crime rates we've had in our lifetime. Not only did he take a job working for the state's attorney, he tried to become the chief of North Brantford, and he was competing against his own assistant chiefs who wanted to become the chief of North Brantford, and he just had the wrong degree. He had a Yale Divinity degree, and he had a criminal justice degree. They're all jumping ship, and crime is at its lowest it's been in my lifetime.
They're all jumping ship, meaning, and all these officers are leaving the force. Why are they leaving the force?
It's because we have a dilemma that does face other cities as well. New Haven made two decisions years ago. One was we wanted to do community policing. We had high crime, and we thought that involved having a lot of officers walking the beat. Then we also created some great task forces that went through cold cases and worked with state's attorney on gangs, and it worked. We have lower crime, and people really want that. But the other thing we did as well, so that costs more. We have the biggest police force in the state. The other thing we did was we said that we don't want cops to leave because they pay more in the suburbs. They pay $15,000 to $20,000 more to be a cop in a suburb where you're a lot safer and you get a lot better health care and pensions. So we did with some other cities that said you can retire in 20 years. So they come at 21 years old, 41, you got your pension, you go somewhere else. People started resenting that. New Haven, like other New Haven cities, Connecticut cities, as well as suburbs, are having financial pressures because of all of our non-for-profit, non-taxable land that's a long discussion, but the basic is you're screwed if you're a city and you have a lot of land owned by nonprofits. So it's hard to pay our bills. So it became untenable. So everyone got mad at the cops or at the lawmakers who gave those provisions, but you have to go back and look why they did it. We needed cops. We couldn't have them all leave a generation ago, and we couldn't have them all, we needed them on the street. So now we have to make a decision. So while there's been a lot of drama, like, oh my God, how can the police chief go for some like lower status job and they're all leaving, and this is a concern, it's not because anyone's doing anything wrong. It's not really because the lawmakers were mean to the chief when he said everyone knew for a year the chief was going. And it isn't because the police are they're kind of selfish, they want a lot of money, that we brought them here on a deal on certain terms. So we really have to make the decisions in New Haven. It's a tough decision, and other cities are going to have to make them too. If you want to keep your crime rates low, and it comes from a lot of factors, there are national trends that keep crime rates low and other reasons too. We also, Yale New Haven Hospital really does a great job of shooting victims. But do we feel you need to have all these cops walking the beat, and there's a good debate about that. I don't know how much you want to go into that.
Some people
say that that's what community policing was. Other people say, like one of the retired chief, John Valleca, says, in fact, a good cop, when he's walking the beat or driving, if he's driving or she, will get out of the car and walk and get to know people. If you're not a good cop, you're not trained well, you're going to hide in the corner. That we have stuff like ShotSpotter and other methods that we can do it more efficiently. We don't need all these cops. You update what community policing is based on the values rather than what the surface idea is. And also, because we had a corruption scandal in 2009 with the FBI came in, we hired all these assistant chiefs and all these layer of bureaucracy maybe don't need. So that's a nice dream people have. Oh, we can always just cut the fat. But it is possible you can train them different. I actually do believe we should have a smaller force that's well-trained and pay them well, because I do think cops should get paid in New Haven what they get paid in Hamden and Avon.
But you also, Kalila, at the start of this, you have a police chief right now who has presided over this lower crime rate. And by all accounts, he's somebody I've spent time with, a lot of us have spent some time with, a good communicator, seemingly very well liked, and as Paul was saying from his degree, very well learned. I mean, this is a guy who cares about the whole life, and it seems as though more cities would want police chiefs like that. All the other things being equal, leadership is really, really important in jobs like these.
Leadership is important. Temperament is critical for someone in law enforcement to be the public face of law enforcement in this city with all of the concerns that people have. So someone who can communicate with their force, communicate with the public, and communicate with different sectors of the public. And I truly believe that Chief Campbell is a good and decent person. And I think that says a lot about his character. But this is a structural problem, as Paul mentioned. You can change the players. You can, you know, switch around who will be chief or the assistant chiefs, and there is still a structural problem that forces us to decide, do we want good policing or do we want policing that we can afford? That has an impact on our training academies. So are we, as New Haven, bearing the cost of training these people to then create potential employees for other towns? But also, how do we create the pipeline? There's a real issue about who is eligible to serve as a police officer. And, you know, how do we look at people's drug histories or their criminal histories? Should that be a barrier? What does that mean for having local people make the move into a local police department? And again, this is a New Haven crisis right now, but it's not unique to the city. And I'm really concerned about what this will mean long term for things like department morale, but also this wonderful lower violent crime rate that we've enjoyed. Will that change once you start moving around the players?
Yeah, because I think New Haven has had its successes in large part because of that lower crime rate. Paul Best, let's go back to you. It's not just what's happening with the police force, though. I mean, it seems as though city finances are in trouble. We're talking about shortfalls within the New Haven school system. What can you tell us about the state of New Haven's finances? And I know Jonathan is going to want to talk about how this is going to play into the mayor's race here.
Yeah, and Jonathan, I think I could be wrong. I think we see this almost exactly the same. I mean, there's a structural challenge facing cities. New Haven's finances are not as bad as Hartford's or Bridgeport's or West Haven's or Hamden's, but they have serious challenges because we can't tax 54% of our property and rely on a property tax. The state has not been giving us permission for an idea that the Republicans I speak to support, which is to allow us to put a 1% surtax on concert tickets and restaurant meals. And so I think that structure, we did one big mistake in New Haven that's really going to haunt us. So we did something called scoop and toss, which what Hartford did, which brought them to the brink of bankruptcy. For the next few years, we're going to have to pretend we have $30 million a year that we don't have because we went and restructured our debt to get upfront cash that will cost us a lot more in the long run. And we just did that last year. So now people run the city when they got caught with their doing that. They said, well, we'll come up with a 5-year plans. We're going to have to make structural changes. Cities are going to have to decide we're not going to do some things we used to do because we've already wrung a lot of efficiencies out of our government. And I think that's the challenge facing us. The school board faces a $30 million structural deficit. The city faces a $30 million structural deficit. You know, out of a budget, operated budget of $530 million, that's not the end of the world. I think you are going to have to say we're going to do across-the-board cuts. Like, for instance, you might have to say small business development is going to have to be done by an independent nonprofit arm. We can't maybe have to combine. I'm getting in the weeds, aren't I?
Yeah,
we're going to have to combine our Livable City Initiative with the Economic Development Administration and have fewer people up top. We're going to have to increase work that brings in fees like inspecting slumlords.
But it's. I don't think it is in the weeds, Jonathan, because it really is, as Kalila said earlier, it's what's facing all of the other cities in the state. We're all having to figure out how we cut, how we have the types of services we need to have while actually trying to bring businesses in, while trying to provide the services that we need to provide.
Well, not to mention, you know, you bring back regionalism. How do you deal with this in terms of sharing resources to help address some of the problems, not just with this city, but even within, you know, within the region, at least, other towns? And I still have a concern also about pension reforms and what to do about that, right, Paul? I mean, that's a big issue that we've spoken a lot about, too. And it's not unique to, as you said, John, just in New Haven, but you see in other cities like Hartford, for example. So I'd love to see maybe what can the state do to address a lot of this. So it might have to go back to the state in terms of finding pathways of dealing with these long-term issues for cities like New Haven and Hartford.
But the state doesn't have any money. Well, how's the state going to help? I mean, Hartford's going to be first at the door, knocking on the door asking for money.
There's a simple answer. Hartford can do. They can allow us to put the 1% surcharge on on restaurant meals and tickets. They can stop stealing the money they promised us under payment in lieu of taxes by statute. They can return some of that. And yes, you're right. What's not being mentioned is that New Haven's doing great. New Haven's doing better than I've ever seen it, better than it's ever done since the beginning of the 20th century. We just have, we're inventing the quantum computers. We have the lab that just opened. I mean, we're creating jobs. We've had population growth, the only city in the state. It's a fun place to live. We just have some real structural government issues that all cities are facing that I think we're going to deal better with than everybody. If the state would mostly stop just stealing from us and get in the way of us solving problems, I think we'll be just fine.
I'm just writing down, stop stealing from New Haven, Kalila.
Paul is so incredibly reserved today. Look, I want to say this. New Haven often feels like a tale of two cities. Mm. So yes, you have sectors that are thriving. We see wonderful entrepreneurial efforts. I mean, the district, the way that it's growing and attracting new businesses and new opportunities is fantastic. But you then have a sector of the city that is saying, with all that is going on in particular pockets, we still don't have access to affordable housing. And with all of the new builds, where are the people who are talking about what it means to be a working family in this city and still not be sure if your kid can go to a school where they will get a quality education or where you can provide, you know, comfort for your child to know that they have a home to go to. So we have to address that. And that kind of division, I think, is something that is structural, but it's also about how we prioritize what we want to happen and who we want to be leading that charge.
And that's a lovely transition, Kalila. Thank you very much to me asking Jonathan Wharton first about this, about what happens in terms of leadership. Justin Ellicker has jumped once again into the race against Tony Harp. Not sure what we've heard from Tony Harp yet. I'm reading from Paul Bass in the New Haven Independent. Justin Ellicker went on Dateline New Haven with Paul and was pressed for some specifics about how he might structurally change things. Maybe he didn't have so many right now. What do you see in this race?
I'm kind of fascinated with it because this is going to be, you know, are we revisiting the election back in 2013, right? I mean, that's the big question. And I'm also curious to find out, who are the other candidates who are going to jump in this? Because in New Haven especially, and I know this firsthand as a former party chairman, the preference is oftentimes decided before even the primary, right, at the party convention for the Democrats. So how many Democratic candidates are we going to see challenge somebody like, you know, incumbent mayor Tony Harp? And so I'm curious as to, we're going to see, what, two, three other candidates. When is the mayor going to jump into the race officially? Is it going to be next month, I'll assume? Could it be this
month? Well, the mayor has said publicly, I am running. Mm-hmm. I will announce. If she does run, there are a whole bunch of serious candidates who will not run. Michael Smart, the city clerk, Juan mm-hmm. Condalari, state rep. Mm-hmm. So it's, I believe that if she runs, it's going to be her against Justin Ellicker. And I think we have two elections in New Haven. We have a primary now, and unlike in the past, we do have a general election because there are 15,000 unaffiliated voters. It's the growing sector. I think Jonathan's right. The two ran against each other in 2013. Tony Harp was a popular state senator everyone knew, and Justin Ellicker was kind of new out of the box. He didn't grow up here, and he'd been in Alderman for 3 years, but he ran a really good campaign, and he came to 45% of the vote. He got the votes from the New Haven, the people moving in, who are kind of attracted to it as a vibrant new urbanist place. Tony Harp, even though she often had policies that she promoted as a legislator that were ahead of the curve on environment and new urbanism, was associated with the old New Haven. People knew who she was in the older politics. That new Haven has continued to grow. Ward 7 is the downtown ward. That used to be in the middle of the pack out of 30 wards in voting turnout. It is now number one. That is Justin Ellicker's district. And same with like Ward 20. The highest voting districts are the ones that go for Justin Ellicker. But Tony Harp remains very popular and known in, especially not just the black community, but people who've kind of been around New Haven. The big question mark is the Unite Here unions. It's not all of labor in New Haven. They're not even a team. It's the Yale unions, most powerful unions in town that control the Board of Alders. And they, if they decide to throw in a candidate, that candidate wins. They more often like to see a weaker mayor they can control, so they control the legislature because they're savvy that way. So I think that's going to be one of the big questions.
I'll just ask you quickly, Kalila, what's your thoughts on this? And again, we understand if we're going to have an election coming up, and we need to make sure that New Haven can actually conduct an election with like people getting their ballots and, you know, not standing in line at the polls.
And it's not raining that day.
And it's not raining that day. I know. So the wet ballots. But I mean, what do you see in this?
Again, it's the issue of structure. And I think we should also understand the way that issues of race will play out in this election in terms of how people align themselves, the kinds of issues and their view on what progress has been made and the opportunities for change. So I'm happy to announce today I'm running for mayor. Jonathan Wharton will be my campaign manager. Paul Bassam will be my communications director. And our slogan is...
You don't even have to run on the Democratic line. I can find pathways to the Republican side.
You don't need a communications director, just no offense, but I'm happy to serve.
Our slogan is, why not? So you've heard it today. Breaking news.
Oh, good. I'm glad that we've got some breaking news. We will break right now, and when we come back, we're going to get maybe some feats of strength from our panelists and also perhaps a few grumbles. We'll also talk about how the Hartford Current maybe is going union. Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, Jonathan Wharton from SCSU, and Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent and WNHH. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. We are live from our New Haven studios at Gateway Community College. Colin McEnroe is once again recuperating, but we do hear from him on Twitter. He is listening today, so hi, Colin. We're here with Paul Bass. He's the editor of the New Haven Independent, and he also has this great little radio station here, WNHH, that you can listen to all sorts of community radio about New Haven and about the state. It's very, very cool, and it's something to be very proud of here in the Elm City. Also with us today is Dr. Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, just up the road in Hamden, and Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Urban Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University, right here. It's officially located in New Haven.
It is. Hamden and New Haven. It's
Hamden and
both.
New Haven.
Yeah.
It's right across the border. Mm-hmm. A couple of stories to get to before we get to maybe some of our feats of strength today. Paul Bass, what do you make of the Hartford Current journalists attempting to unionize, banding together? This is obviously a much smaller workforce for the oldest continuously published newspaper in America than they used to have. So it's something like 60, 70 people who are joining this. What does this say to you about journalism? What does it say to you about the Hartford Current?
I have two thoughts on it.
Yeah.
Obviously, 1,000% support the reporters at the Current. I hope you get your union. I hope you get good terms. These union organizing drives happen when business models are failing. You saw DNA Info Chain with Joseph Ricketts. They formed the union. The place closed. It wasn't just because they formed a union. The model didn't work. BuzzFeed, now they're forming a union. So I think the Current, unfortunately, whatever happens with the union isn't going to matter. Either Hearst is going to buy them and just own everything in our lives in Connecticut, or Alden Capital Hedge Fund or one of the other hedge funds are going to buy it. The game's over.
I don't know. Kalila?
Not much to fight over
there. Yeah.
That's okay. There's so much good journalism that's not happening in corporate greedy newsrooms. I'm fine with it.
And there is, and increasingly so, but Kalila, it does sort of, it speaks to something about that business model. There are still these big newspapers. When people talk about the Hartford Current shrinking over time, it is absolutely undoubtedly true that it was a much bigger news operation, a much bigger newsroom back in the day. However, it's still about, you know, three or four times bigger than our newsroom here at WNPR, three or four or five or 10 times bigger than Paul Bass's newsroom at the New Haven Independent. And so it's still a very powerful institution, but yet it's in this precarious place.
That's the context that matters. So that, yes, downsizing should be an issue of concern for some people, but it's also about your ability to deliver news that people need that is relevant and to efficiently deliver that, given the changing in technology and the ways that people access that. I think it is a sad commentary, though, that in this era when journalists are so needed, when the work that you all do is so important, there are these questions about sustainability and that, yes, you deliver a public service, but you also need to have protection and be able to pay your bills too.
Local news matters, and as somebody who teaches state and local politics, which is a rare breed around here, it does matter in terms of your information source. And so, as you all are saying here, I mean, that's why it's so critical to see not just, you know, WNPR and certainly Paul's, you know, New Haven Independent, but also something like the Hartford Current remain following at least these state and local issues. It does matter for people just to know what is going on in their own communities.
Do you feel you need it? If you read the Connecticut Mirror and Connecticut News Junkie, do you think you need the Hartford Current?
Well, one thing I will say is, and for people who don't know, you know, the Connecticut Mirror provides an awful lot of stories to the Hartford Current and to the Hearst newspapers.
And in fact, those hedge funds that are squeezing and the other corporate owners, these companies, they're going to the real journalism nonprofit sector and trying to get it cheap like you're outsourcing to India. And we don't need their delivery models. No one's really buying their print anymore anyway.
I want to get some either grievances, if you have some, or perhaps feats of strength. I'll start with you first, Paul. What do you have this week?
Well, I want to do a shout out to Gregory Dash. He's an officer in the New Haven Police Department. He was an Army medic for 7 years, learned how to save lives, and he never had to put that into use. He became one of the first New Haven cops to learn how to use a tourniquet on the scene. If someone's bleeding, there's not going to be enough time to save their lives before they get in the ambulance. Mm. And on the day when the last person was being trained, he was the first person to save a life. Two men had been shot on the porch in Shelton Avenue, New Hallville. He was there. He immediately recognized the bright red blood was flowing so profusely from the top of the guy's leg, he wasn't going to make it in 3 minutes. And he used the tourniquet and he saved the life. And shout out to Gregory Dash.
That's an amazing story. And a real shout out to him. And thank you for sharing that, Paul. How about you, Jonathan?
Well, I think we spoke about this earlier. You know, I just have a big pet peeve out there. You know, considering it just snowed, people need to slow down. I was only taking 95 here, a couple exits, and I could not believe the amount of snow missiles coming at me behind with two cars.
Ice missiles.
Thank you. So word choice matters. So I just say, everybody slow down. It just snowed. I'm not trying to go 70 miles per hour here.
Well, I will say, too, I'd mentioned this to you before the show. Mm-hmm. You know, Governor Jody Rell, mm-hmm. During her time in office, she made ice missiles a real priority. She yep. cared about that. And it is illegal to have snow or ice on top of your car or on the hood of your car that you've not cleared off. I mean, this is an important piece of, I don't know, big government legislation, Jonathan Wharton, that maybe you would really get behind.
Well, of course, I'm also privileged because I live in a condo where it's covered garage parking, so I don't have to worry about clearing my car. So many of my students make comments, why is your car always so clean?
Privilege.
Okay, now listen, professor, don't throw the privilege on me. You're the one that's tenured.
Oh, yeah. That's we may have opened up an entirely new line of questioning here. I'll go to you, Kalilah. Go ahead.
So anyone who knows me knows that I love Virginia and I also love sports. So my feat of strength this week is for the University of Virginia men's basketball team, who defeated the University of North Carolina on Monday while Michael Jordan was watching. But I think the power of that team, that in the midst of all this chaos, they're coming together. They're bringing people together for something joyful and happy. So kudos to them.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I'm going to end with a feat of strength here, and I'll maybe ask our panelists, nobody knows what I'm going to talk about, to weigh in a little bit. I lost a friend last week, a woman named Noelle Gray, who was a friend to public radio, and she appeared on several of our radio programs over the years. She was introduced to me by journalist and photographer Jonathan Henninger. She is someone who was a comedian. She was a very vibrant person, and she lived for a very long time with a series of terrible cancers that seemingly crept into her body every single time she had made some progress. I think that she taught me, certainly, and taught a lot of people how to think and talk about the idea of cancer. I don't know about you, Paul. I've had people in my life who've been touched by it, but you never know what to say. And somebody who goes through it for a very long time, especially someone who's funny and bracing and bold, will tell you, here's what to say, here's what not to say, here's what I need from you, here's what I don't need from you. And I feel like that's a real service to other people.
I do. And I think my role is always, I think you listen.
Yeah. You listen and hear what people need to say. I don't know, Jonathan, it's something that has touched all of our lives. I mean, the idea that cancer is something that is in so many people's families, it is amongst so many people's friends, it feels like a feat of strength for someone to live with it for such a long time with good humor and to be able to teach others about it.
Not to mention, you know, survivors of it as well. How do they overcome and how do they deal with that? So it is critical.
Kalilah, how about you? I mean, I'm assuming this is something that's touched your life in some way as well, like everyone else.
It has, and I didn't realize that Noelle had passed away until you just said that. I actually met her because of the show when we did one of the live tapings, and she came. One of the things that I think I learned from her, that sort of a reverent sense of humor, is that she is a survivor. Although she's made her transition, she's a survivor because she has changed the conversation. She has made people, particularly the ways that she would go at public officials, to say, you can't say you care about your voters and not think about access to health care, to not think about what it means for the family who is helping people. So in that way, she is a survivor. And I just want to thank her for that sense of humor that she brought to this, because I think it reminds all of us of what we're called to do.
Yeah, and this idea of access to health care, the ability of people across the country to be able to get something, Kalilah, that is meaningful to them, so that they don't have to struggle through the system while they're struggling through health outcomes. That is one of the biggest problems, I think, with our current broken health care mm-hmm. system, is that people who are at the worst, lowest part of their life in terms of their physical health have to go through the just awful procedures to get the health care that they need.
And that they're fighting not just for themselves, but for other people as well, to understand it doesn't have to be this way. And there are changes we can make to give people a true quality of life in this most vulnerable moment.
Yeah.
Okay. Paul? I hate to be so political, but
go for it.
Just get rid of the insurance companies. They exist only to make money by not giving us the health care we need and then make you sicker when you try to get it when you need it.
Good luck trying doing that in Connecticut. I dare you to try to bring
tomorrow.
That to Harvard.
Wow.
It's always a good conversation with my friends Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent and the founder of WNHH here in New Haven. Thank you, Paul, for joining us. I really appreciate
it. Great to be with everyone.
Thanks also to Dr. Jonathan Wharton, assistant professor of political science at Urban Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University. You can follow him on Twitter at PreppyProf. Hi there. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And bringing this to Elm City. Thank
you. And thanks to Dr. Kalila Brandine, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University at KBD, PhD. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
Thanks to Scott Breedy and Jonathan McNichol and everyone who helped produce today's show.